Well, hello, everybody. This is Steve Krohn. I'm here with my partner, Mariam Zahr, for the next episode of the Palisades podcast. That beautiful musical introduction was performed about 5 minutes ago by our guest here at Village Studios. I am thrilled and honored to welcome Justice Arthur Gilbert, an old friend, a colleague, a mentor of mine, and it's truly an honor for me to have him here. Mariam, you want to say hi?
Hey, Steve. How's it going this week?
Well, same as last week, and for the foreseeable future, I'm afraid.
Less of a lockdown, though, in the last week, no?
Yeah, a little bit, which may be more of a problem in the future. We'll deal with that.
We'll deal with that. Arthur, it's a pleasure to welcome you onto the Palisades podcast. Thank you so much for joining us this week. I'm looking forward to talking to you. Arthur is an introduction to the Pali podcast by Steve, who has huge ties in the Palisades, and Arthur was someone that he's recommended for months and months. So it's a pleasure for me to meet you, and I'm looking forward to this conversation.
Well, me too. Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
So let me, for the few people that don't know who Art Gilbert is, let me give you just a quick introduction. Art Gilbert is currently the presiding justice of Division 6 of the California Court of Appeal for the 2nd District. He's been a judge for 45 years, both on the Los Angeles Municipal and Superior Courts, and he's been on the Court of Appeal for 37 years. He has acquired a reputation as one of the most eloquent, articulate justices anywhere in the country. Anybody who's read his opinions knows that he not only uses sound logic, but resorts to literature, to music, to a wide variety of sources to get his points across. And he's also, for the last 31 years, been writing a column for the Los Angeles Daily Journal, which, for those of you that don't know, that's the legal newspaper in Los Angeles. 31 years, he's been writing a monthly column called Under Submission, in which Art takes sometimes minor incidents and evaluates them, often through the prism of the law. Sometimes he'll talk for episodes at a time about his cat and how his cat or series of cats has impacted some issue in the law or in Art's life. And so it's a column that applies to lawyers, it applies to people who just want to learn a little bit more about life and the law. And I personally am proud to say that I've been a friend of Art since 1976. Which is coincidentally the year that Art moved into the Palisades. Same house for all these years. So let's talk about that. What got you to move into the Palisades in 1976?
Well, let's see. I just have to say one thing about the music. So we walk into a studio. We're going to do this podcast. And it's a recording studio. And I see a Steinway piano. And the engineer tells me that Oscar Peterson played on this piano. So I said, I'm playing this piano, sorry. I sat down at the piano and just started playing, and he recorded it. And that's on the spot, an event that he recorded, and we opened our podcast with that. That was really quite an exciting moment.
Absolutely. No rehearsal.
No, nothing.
No forethought.
See a piano and I'll play it.
Absolutely.
So the Palisades, how did I get into the Palisades? Well, when I got onto the court, I was living in an apartment, and a friend of mine lived in the Palisades, and he said, you really have to live here. This is a wonderful place. And I drove by. I lived in West LA, and I just fell in love with the place. And he said, you got to use my agent. And my agent took me to a house. And I said, this is the house I want. And she said, well, let me show you a few others. I said, no, I want this house. She said, you really should see some others. I said, okay, I saw some others. We went back to that house.
To the same house.
And I made an offer on it. And we closed almost immediately. It took about a week, a little bit of negotiating. I hate to tell you what I paid for the house.
But I know. But
and what it's worth now. But anyway, so I lived in that house with my cat. And it was absolute nirvana, and it has been ever since. We're right off a bluff. We can see the ocean. And then I got married, and Barbara and I lived in this house, and it was kind of an old ranch house. And she said, you know, I think maybe we should remodel or whatever. And I had a friend of mine who I went to grammar school with, who is an architect. And I said, do you want to build us a house? And he said, okay. So we took the house down and built our dream house. And I think we completed it in 1986. And they're going to carry me out of that house. I'll never leave it. It is just, to live in the Palisades is absolute paradise.
And without disclosing the name, how did you find your contractor for that house?
Oh, yes. Let's see. So Steve, who I knew from the court, because he had been a public defender, appeared in my court, and I was bragging to him about the Palisades, and he came to the Palisades, and he said, I have a contractor who's working on this house. I said, who is it? And so I interviewed him, and that's the contractor that built our house.
Not without a few hiccups, but
the house was built. But the house, we have it, we love it. And we see him occasionally. I work out at the gym with his brother. We see each other every once in a while. And we have a very cordial, good relationship.
It's such a small community. It's kind of cool that you can still see your contractor at the gym. But I want to ask you, was it a simpler time? I mean, I find myself asking our older neighbors the same question. You know, they'll tell me the streets are the same and there are the same number of houses everywhere. But somehow it seems every time I hear somebody talk about the Palisades, you know, years ago, not 10 or 15 years ago, more than that, it just seems like it was a simpler time.
Oh, absolutely. No question. In fact, when I moved in, I would describe to my friends, it was like a time warp. I thought I had moved into the 40s. It was like a Twilight Zone movie. There weren't any restaurants. There was a pizza place. At 6 o'clock, the town closed. I mean, it was like there was very little happening here. There was a wonderful small community. There were a lot of elderly people living here. I was one of the younger ones. I was in my 30s when I moved in. There were small kind of tract homes built in the 50s. Pali High had been, I think it was in the 60s when Pali was constructed. And Temescal Canyon, I knew people who were grown up now who played in Temescal Canyon when it was a canyon, not a street.
Wow.
It went all the way down to the, to the Pacific Coast Highway. And so, and then people start moving. And I said to myself, I said, boy, I have to buy property here. Because this place is going to boom sometime. And I was too busy with the court. I didn't have the time. And now you have to get the financing and everything else. When I moved in, interest rates were unbelievable. They were like 12 to 14%. And I had cashed out of my law firm. I'd been a partner in the law firm. And we owned the building. And so I had some money when I became a judge. So I had the money to make a down payment. I was lucky. But I just happened to have the funds because of the law firm. So I was able to get the house. And then you keep refinancing as time goes on to bring it down. And now there's construction everywhere. There are much younger people moving in with children. And also a lot of movie people. There's more wealthy people living here. And it's a different ethos. Yet it also retains some of the kind of small town community.
It really does.
Yeah. So it still has... it's still a homey place to be.
It's true. And I feel like a lot of people put in a lot of effort to try to preserve that still small town, homey feel community. Even though modernity is coming and things are growing and developing, I still feel like this is one pocket where you can still land and feel like it's small and it's old and it's still quaint.
But I find the congestion around 3 or 4 o'clock was nothing like when I moved in.
Oh, I'm sure.
You could shoot a cannon down Sunset Boulevard anytime, and there would hardly be anybody here. And now it's a whole different community. And particularly since the Caruso development came in, things have really changed dramatically.
Definitely so.
So in my linear approach to this, I wanted to go back with you to when you first got appointed to the bench. What was it that caused you to want to be on the bench? You had been in a deputy city attorney, private practice.
Right.
And what? You're single and...
Yeah, I'm single.
What makes you make that decision?
I was practicing law, and to be quite candid, the more successful we became, the more the quality of my life was eroding. That's just a true statement. I was good in court and we had to look successful and act successful, and we were. We had our own building. And I like the idea of bringing a problem to a solution instead of representing some clients who I didn't always agree with and being using my skills to get a result, which I think lawyers have to do. And I was in court quite often, and there were some judges I admired and some I didn't. And I just had an instinct about what a judge should do. And I just thought to myself, if I were a judge, this is how I would conduct my court. And Jerry Brown had, I wound up managing actually Ed Edelman's campaign.
Oh, wow.
I was a co-manager. I had dated his sister-in-law. That's how I knew him. I was a young bachelor. I got married later in life. I was, how old was I? 43 when I got married. And Barbara, she had never been married before either. We had dated for, I'm backing up a little. We had dated in the early 70s, and we broke up and didn't see each other for 5 years. And everybody said, they're going to get married. It's going to be a while. And I bumped into her father. It's a long story. He called her. She called me. We got together, and we were married within a year. So anyway, so
Art, it sounds like your instincts guide you pretty well. It was the first house, the first woman.
You got it. I think that luck has really smiled on me. There's a phrase, I think, I looked it up. Heraclitus was a Greek philosopher, and I think he said it. Luck favors the prepared mind. And so I managed Ed's campaign, and I knew Jerry Brown. Because when I was in school, in law school, he was an undergraduate. We lived at International House, and we became friends. And we talked about all kinds of things. I don't know if he, I reminded him that I helped him fill out his law school application. When he was, I recall this, he was running for a board of trustees on the college, junior college boards of trustees. And he told me about it, and I watched the debate and told him what I thought of it. And then he said, I'm running for Secretary of State. And I said, why would you want to run for that? It's a position that goes nowhere. You want your name on every corporation. So it turned out during the Watergate thing, he became very prominent because they had falsified some documents. And as time went on, I helped him with his campaign while I was doing Ed Edelman's campaign. And he appointed me. And he pointed me to the municipal court. I wrote him a little.
Really?
I wrote him a little note once, and I said, "Hey Jerry, I'd be interested if you're so inclined to, consider me for a judgeship." Enough. He wasn't appointing anyone for 8 months. He wanted to save money and do all that. And then I get a call in my office. "Hey Art, how you doing?" Wow. And we're having this discussion. "Oh, by the way, I'm appointing you to the municipal court."
Which is where I first met you.
Where you and I met.
I think in 76.
Yeah, in 76.
You were a municipal court judge.
Yeah. But before we met, I was in traffic court.
Right.
And I became everybody called me the king of traffic court. That's where you had real power. What I did, and it's all coming back to me now, is I noticed that people from Latin America, Mexican people, Spanish speaking people, didn't really understand tickets and what it meant to come to court. And so I was talking to one of the bailiffs who was from Mexico, and he said, this isn't fair. I said, you're darn right it isn't fair. And so I just said, let's have the tickets translated into Spanish. And I called up the police department, called everybody, called one of the senators, Alla Torre, who I knew. I said, hey, let's do this. And I called Ed Edelman, who was a supervisor, and I got it done.
That's
almost
amazing.
Overnight. And we start doing that, and all the papers covered it, and I was just thrilled,
That's amazing. And now we take it so much for granted all those citations are going to be translated into any language. I mean, a slew of languages now.
Of course.
That's amazing. I see that you also instituted an outreach program for college and high school students.
Yeah.
So to me, it's emerging. And Steve, kudos to you and I, because we always end up having guests who have this like greater social consciousness about a better world to live in. And Art is one of them. So to me, it seems like you went through the public system for school, right?
Yeah.
You went to UCLA and then you went to Berkeley Law School. I'd love to hear what you think about the UC system as it transforms. But then, you had a successful career in law. You became a judge. And this entire time, it seems to me like you had an eye on making this society a better place to live in. And so like this instituting the high school program, to this day, if we could manage to get high school kids to learn more about civic issues and understand more about the real policies that impact their lives, we'd probably have a better set of policies, even at this moment. So how did you come across that idea and how hard was it to instate?
Well, I just always felt that the judges should be open to the community. I started community service as well, where people, you know, who didn't do serious crimes could do something in the community to give back. And I've been speaking at Paul Revere here in the Palisades Junior High every year. And boy, are they terrific. I mean, I have so much fun doing it. A friend of mine, Don Scott, who is involved.
Of course we know him.
So anyway, Don said, will you do this with the Optimist Club years ago? And I said, sure. And I had the time. These kids are terrific. They are so smart. And I'm asking them questions. You know, I believe when I give talks, I like to go out in the audience with a microphone. And I like to go have an exchange. So I did this with the kids, and they were smart. And one kid, I said, can they go in your locker and open? The adorable little girl raises her hand, and she says, you need probable cause. So I said,
nice.
I said, I think I know someone whose parents are lawyers. She said, well, my mother was with Gibson Dunn and my father, naming these big law firms. And I spoke on a panel at Pali High. And so I'm available. I spoke at different groups, the Optimist Club, about the courts, what we do. And I like to throw examples out to the group. How would you decide this case? What do you think?
I love that.
Yeah. And it's a lot of fun. And they get a sense of what the courts are all about. And so Steve and I met when he was a public defender and I was then hearing criminal cases.
Right.
And it was hard to win criminal cases. And I still remember your big win. This was a case I thought the guy was so guilty. It was a jury trial. And man, they came in within an hour with a not guilty verdict. And I remember.
Wow.
I remember you giving the client a high five. That was so many years ago. So Steve and I developed some friendships with a number of lawyers. And we've continued that friendship throughout all these years.
Yeah, we met in 76, and then I saw you again. So I was assigned to your courtroom for about 6 months, doing one trial after another.
Yeah.
And then again, when after you moved to Superior Court and you were doing juvenile court.
Oh, wow.
That's right.
Over in Englewood. And I was on, at the time, I was new in private practice. So I was on the Englewood juvenile panel and saw you there all the time, and we maintained a friendship.
You know, you were just talking. There was a class used to come. This is what I've got to tell you this story. You've got to hear this story. I mean, you're talking.
We're going to hear it.
You're going to hear it whether you want to or not.
We are.
Right. So I've got this so I'm sitting in juvenile court in Englewood, right? And this little kid is coming into court all the time at the end of the, you know, like in the afternoon. And he's just a sweet little boy. And we're looking at him. And so I said, hello, what? And he says, hello, where do you go to school? And then the bailiffs and everybody's talking to him. And I bring him into chambers. And I says, how come you come to? I'm so glad you're here. What do you think? Well, he goes to school up the street and this and that. And he's entering. So I said, well, what's your name? And I said, would you like to bring your class here? And he says, yeah. So I said, well, ask your teacher. Here's my card. Have her call me. So the teacher calls me. I said, this is great. She says, I would love to bring the class. I said, bring him. When do you want to come? So she brings the class.
Wow.
And his name, oh my God, I think it's Raphael. I said, let's have Raphael introduce the class to the court and to me. Can we do that?
How lovely.
She said, he's a little shy, but we'll work on it. So they bring the whole class in. He's there. This little tiny kid, and he gets up, and I said, tell him I'm your friend. And he says, this is my friend, Arthur. Something like, I like to be, I mean, people call me Justice, you know, I'm the presiding justice. I'm not into titles. I really like to be called by my name. Around the court, everybody calls, I'm Arthur. When you're on the bench, then the lawyer, you know, I have to have the formality. So listen, so he comes, he introduces me, I meet the class and everything. And then, you know, he graduates, I don't see him. Years go by. I'm at the Court of Appeal now. This is like 30-some years later. And the clerk calls me and says, there's someone in the foyer who would like to see you. And I said, yeah, who is it? His name is Raphael.
Wow.
I said, what? And she said, he knew you when you were in juvenile. I said, oh my God. I go downstairs and there's this huge guy. He's 6'2". I said, my God, and we're hugging. I mean, I was in tears. I couldn't believe it. So what's going on? He tells me his life story. He's tracked me down because I made a difference in his life. I get emotional when I tell
that. Oh my goodness. That is a great story.
And so then it turned out I knew someone that was running a traffic school and they needed someone bilingual. I got him a job and he was doing the traffic school.
Oh, that's wonderful. I was actually going to ask you, did it prompt a career in the law for him? Because
no.
That must have been a moment that made a difference for him.
I don't know if it did. We lost track. I don't know what happened.
I love that.
You know, the nice thing about juvenile is that you oftentimes can make a big difference mm-hmm. in a kid's
yeah,
life.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, you catch them before, you know, maybe they're dabbling with some criminal activity and you catch them, you get them into a program. You know, there's a guy that I represented when I was in juvenile court charged with a Palisades robbery, and we got the charge reduced and placed on probation, ultimately got his record sealed. That person is now a deputy district attorney
wow.
here in Los Angeles.
Yeah.
I ran into him in court and he says, you don't remember me, do you? And I said, no, I'm sorry, I don't. And he shows me his name. And I said, oh my God.
Oh,
and Steve, that's amazing.
And yeah. he is, you know, obviously doing well. And so there's
that's amazing.
Juvenile sometimes gets bashed as being, you know, kiddie court and all that,
yeah.
but you can really make a difference.
You can.
So who was the city attorney that you were the assistant, that you worked for? Do you remember?
Yes. His name at that time, oh, that's a story. Very, very conservative. At that time, it was Roger Arnberg.
Okay, let me just tell you something quickly because it ties into the conversation we're having, and then tell us about Roger. So our current city attorney, Mike Feuer, has a program. It's a pilot program called the Neighborhood Justice Program, NJP. I actually went through it because I thought maybe I can volunteer because I think it's such a great idea. And it goes to what you were saying, Steve. They sort of do this intervention for young people. It's for people between the ages of, let's say, 17 and 21, I think. And they have to have no prior offenses. But if they're accused of a misdemeanor, instead of going through the penal system, this pilot sort of takes them out of that, puts them into this neighborhood justice kind of restorative, rehabilitative program where they sort of interface with the community that they've harmed. They begin to understand the consequence of what they've done, and it gives them a chance to rehabilitate and go a different direction. And so I agree with you. I think there are a lot of opportunities to make a difference in people's lives. And funny that your story is about Inglewood, because just next month, our guest is going to be someone who lives in the Palisades now, but grew up in Inglewood, went to Pali High, and that, you know, those exchanges, those people that he met, the things he saw, the experiences that he had changed his life, probably changed the course of his life.
Yeah, you can't tell. Yeah, I know Mike Feuer mm-hmm. quite well, and his wife is a colleague of mine. She sits in another division of the Court of Appeal. So I think he's doing some wonderful things. And then Bert Pines, when I became a judge, Bert Pines was the city attorney.
Mm-hmm.
And we sometimes would butt heads on a few issues in a very friendly way, because I believe that first time people who were charged with driving under the influence, it's not drunk driving, it's driving under the influence, really didn't understand. And I wanted them to go to an education program. And I started that program going. I mean, it was around, but no one was using it. So I helped develop it. And he wanted them to go to jail the first time around. I took him on. And the Times, everyone was covering it. We were on the news. It was a lot of fun. And he and I became really close, dear friends. And he became a judge. In fact, I chair a commission for the governor where we vet people to be on the court. And I've done that for the past 10 years.
What's the commission called?
Well, doesn't have a name. What it is, it's an informal commission, but known.
Is that the kitchen cabinet?
It's like that, but it's not really a kitchen cabinet. We want the public to know what we're doing. And we call and we vet candidates, and then we make suggestions about what candidates the governor might want to set to the Judicial Nominations Evaluation Committee, called the Jenny Committee, that also does a vetting process. Mm-hmm. And we're finding, too, and Jerry Brown was very big on this, He wanted, and I strongly support this, a judiciary that reflects the community. We want to have more minorities, more women. And Jerry Brown started this. I mean, I'm partial to him, obviously. But in his first term, we want to have competence, obviously. Women, minorities, gays, doesn't matter who you are. We want this to reflect the society. And now we have, you know, we're really making strides in that area. And very capable, competent people are on the court, proving that, you know, we can have a wonderful judiciary that is diverse and reflects the community.
So your last assignment, as I recall, as a Superior Court judge, you went over and did civil in Santa Monica, right?
I did.
And then I remember talking with you about your decision to apply for the Court of Appeal and why you made that decision. Will you kind of go through that with us?
Well, I was sitting in Santa Monica, and I was able to get in Santa Monica 3 miles from my house. This was perfect. I would drive down to the courthouse, and my car would say, "What? We're here already?" Because I used to have to drive. I couldn't believe it. My wife would meet me for lunch. In fact, I had a locker downstairs, and I would go swimming, and I would run with the public defenders at lunchtime. I mean, this was absolutely perfect. And I said, "I'm not leaving Santa Monica ever. This is where I'm staying for the rest of my life."
And that was 37 years ago.
That was, And I said, "I'm staying here." Now, I know that I was told that I had a good reputation, that the governor and the administration thought I was pretty good and that I applied for the Court of Appeal. I don't even remember applying for the Court of Appeal, to be honest with you. I was going to be appointed, I was told, before I did. And there was a division they had picked out for me, I was told. I didn't know this. And then there was a lawsuit to stop it. I didn't forget about it. It was in the back of my mind. But anyway, I get a call from the governor, and it's sort of at the end of, and oh, I'm sorry. There was a ruling that the creation of some new judgeships for the Court of Appeal was constitutional and proper. So I get a call from Jerry Brown, and he says, "Okay, I'm appointing you to the Court of Appeal." Wow, gee, Jerry, And he says, "In Santa Barbara." I said, "What?" I said, no, Jerry, I don't live." He says, "I know, but that's where he says, "It'll be great. You'll be doing a lot of environmental law and farm worker stuff that you'd be great at." And that's so I said, "But I don't live there." And he was joking. He says, "Well, you can go up. You'll move up there. We'll move up." So he said, "Well," I said, "Jerry, I really appreciate it." And he's got his staff on that. And I said, "Arthur, are you out of mind? Take this." So he says, "I'm going to give you 2 hours to think about it because I've got to make other appointments. So call me back." So I don't know what to do. I call a good friend of mine and I said, "God, you know, and my wife wasn't home. I had no one to talk to." And I'm saying to myself, "If I don't take this, I'll be kicking myself for the rest of my life. See what happens. You know, luck favors the, you know." So I go back and I call him and everybody's on the phone. "Yes, yes." So I said, "Yeah, Jerry, I'm going to take it." And he said, "Well, I certainly hope you decide your cases with greater dispatch." Which was just—
That's very funny.
Absolutely. And God, we were howling. So I had a real welcome. There was a certain disappointment because I wasn't from the bench up there, you know, but I just fit into the community and loved it. And we were able to move our court facilities to Ventura. The rent was cheaper. We saved money for the state. Nobody cared where our chambers were.
And you built a whole new courthouse.
And we built a whole new courthouse.
It's beautiful.
And it turned out.
So yet again, your instincts served you well.
They did. I went with it.
Yeah. It's funny. I think that anyone who's kind of on in the years looks back at all of the decisions that they had to make that sometimes maybe seemed uncomfortable or out of the blue. And you realize that every single one of those decisions literally alters the way, you know, the course of your future.
Everything.
To some degree. You said at the beginning that when you were a practicing attorney, you had this notion of what you would be like if you were a judge. Now you've been a judge for many, many years. When you look back at that moment, do you think that you were the judge you thought you'd be?
You're going to have to ask the lawyers who appear in front of me. I do my best, but my wife will tell you this. I'm extremely self-critical. I'm never satisfied with anything. I'm never satisfied with an opinion I write. I'm never satisfied when I play the piano. It's not that I'm driving. I'm not driven. I'm really not. I even think, some people think, my God, look at all the things you do. You're so involved in this and that. I think I'm kind of not lazy, but, you know, I'm thinking about things when I'm walking and working out. And I look back on things I did. And when you get to be my age, I think the two of you will do the same. Or maybe you're doing it now. I look back and say, golly, I wish I had done that or not done that. And I think about things I said or something I said to someone that was unkind. And I'm a little ashamed about it. I mean, those things just, strike you. And I remember there was a lawyer in court who I was really tough on. And I felt terrible about it. And the case was over. And I wrote them a letter and apologized. And the lawyer wrote me back. I mean, I had to wait till everything. And I said, I was pretty tough on you. And I said, I shouldn't have done it. And you did a great job anyway. And I said, I don't feel good about it. And I just hope you'll accept. And boy, she wrote a lovely letter back. So I felt good about that.
Yeah, you might have made her a better lawyer.
I don't know. I hope I made myself a better judge.
Yeah, I was going to say, I feel like it's your judgeships aren't all about your decisions. I feel like you use your judgeship to do things, to move the needle, do more than just decide cases.
I personally can vouch for one of the things you said when you said that you used to walk around and think about your opinions all the time and rethink them. And for the maybe 20 years that we were neighbors before I moved up to the Highlands, for three mornings a week, we would run together.
Yes.
Religiously, Tuesday, Thursday, and Saturdays. And a good portion of the time, we'd be running and you'd be saying, I just wrote this opinion. It doesn't feel right. I'm thinking about changing it. You didn't just write an opinion and put it to bed. You were thinking about it long after it was done. I mean, I know that.
Yeah. And well, I might talk in general terms to you, but I can never talk about the specifics of a case.
Correct.
Until it was final. And there was nothing you could do about it anymore.
No, you never did anything improper. Yeah. Okay. I'm going to vouch for that too.
I have to make that clear.
No secret discussions about anything. No, absolutely.
Yeah. And so I'm still doing the same thing. And I'm very conscious about how you write the opinion. I remember a newspaper or a reporter, I guess they don't call them reporters anymore. But anyway, they were analyzing a U.S. Supreme Court decision, and they said it was written in impenetrable prose. And it's true. Some of the cases you read, what are they talking about? And I can understand how a layperson would have some difficulty. Now, it's not always the fault of the Supreme Court. Some of the legislation that's written is so complex, and particularly live in a complex society. So when we're dealing with technical issues, the way some of the statutes are written are very, very difficult. And so they have to deal with that. So I try to say, what is the case about? What is really happening here? And try to write it in a way that anyone reading it could understand it. They may not agree with it, but at least they understand my rationale and how I got there.
Yeah, I was going to say, I don't know how many opinions are really written for with the layperson in mind. So the fact that you do that, I think, is admirable. You clearly like to write. You've been writing a column called Under Submission for a pretty long time.
Yeah.
I've read a couple of them. They're very interesting. They're not case reviews.
No.
They're sort of a deep dive into society, the world around us, policies, judgeships, all of these things. That, again, I think the nuts and bolts of what makes what really impacts the world that we live in. What made you start to write? I mean, what gave you the opportunity to start to write a column? And you've been doing it for many, many years. What keeps you going?
Well, what happened was about some 30 years ago, there was a policy, and it's still there, but it's very seldom used, where the Supreme Court, the California Supreme Court, would depublish an opinion. Now, we write opinions that are in the California reports, lawyers look them up, and we sort of shape and mold the law in California. But we don't publish every case because some are just pedestrian cases. My God, you would be just inundated with cases. So we publish a certain number because there's something unusual about it. It extends the law. It's something new about the law. And if the Supreme Court didn't care for the opinion or thought the result was right but didn't like the reasoning, they would, quote, depublish it.
I didn't know that.
It was sort of like, I used to say it's like the Soviet Union used to rewrite history. You know, this didn't happen.
Right.
And I was an opponent to this. And they did. I had a couple depublished. I didn't have many. But the point is, I just thought it was, for better or worse, it should be out there.
Yeah, kind of so, un-American to depublish.
Yeah, that's what, yeah. And so, and I thought it was a way of controlling their case flow. I was, and Joseph Grodin, who was on the court, a very good friend of mine, wrote a very interesting law review article about publication. While he was on the court, depublication. He really wasn't in favor of it. And he and I talked about it. And so people said to me, you know, I got a call from the Daily Journal, a paper, and said, we understand you don't like depublication or whatever. Why don't you write an article? Well, I said, okay. And I wrote a very creative article that was actually, it was very funny. I don't want to write it didn't have to be scholarly. And I just let my imagination go. And it was very, very funny. I mean, I thought it was good. I still do. And everybody talked about it. It just took off. It had, and it was called It Never Happened.
Mm.
And I tell what you go through psychologically and suddenly it's not there. And I mention all these things. So anyway, then they said, you know, hey, this was, you know, kind of, you got some, you think you'd like to write a column? And I said, oh yeah, maybe, I don't know, okay. So I start writing a column. And that's how it, I mean, that was fortuitous too. It just happened.
Luck prepares the, what? Luck smiles upon the prepared mind.
Yeah, but I'm telling you, people think it's easy. You don't knock them. Nothing is easy. It ain't easy. Playing the piano. If you play the piano, and I don't have as much time to practice as I'd like, but if you play so it sounds effortless and you're playing well, you don't know the type of hours and practice that goes into doing that. So writing a clear opinion or a good column, you don't just knock it out.
Yeah.
You got to think it through. And then there's a deadline. There's deadlines. So it's not always the way you would like it. You can look back and say, oh, why did I say that? Or,
you know. And when you write something, you make reference to literature, to movies, to plays, to a wide variety of things to get your point home. And you are obsessive about the grammar, the words that are used. You've written whole articles about whether a particular adjective was the appropriate adjective that's used all the time. Is that really what they mean to say, or do they mean something else? So when you write something, it's not like throw it out there. You go over it, you think about it, and you spend a lot of time with your writing. Yeah. I know that.
I think the current, it's not a problem, is they. Instead of saying he or she, we don't have gender neutral pronouns. And I always had this problem with the jury. It's a collective noun. So the jury, do you say they for the jury? They decided? The jury is a collective noun. It's really it, but it sounds wrong. So I always used to say the jurors. Now, is they really appropriate to say, you don't want to say he or she? A person might do so-and-so, so they, but they doesn't, is the wrong word. Well, it's been used all the time. We have to now, because I can understand women. Where do you get off he? It's always he. On the other hand, I've been using she, but then she sounds, hey, look at me. I'm using she to show everyone how fair and neutral I am. So I think they is going to be used in the jury instructions, and I can understand language evolves and changes.
Yeah.
And Shakespeare used they, lots of people use they, but they used it in dialogue. It's in informal speech. So I've been writing, my last few columns has been about they, and I am joining the ranks of they.
Are you really?
Yeah.
So that's funny. It comes up. I sit on the City Commission on the Status of Women.
Yes.
And it comes up there.
Yeah.
And I've actually been wondering, I'd love to read what you wrote. I've been wondering if we might come up with a new pronoun in the modern day.
Okay.
Is that possible?
Yeah. I will send you my. In fact, the column I'm writing in July, you know, I don't always just write about one topic necessarily. I try to find a common thread. So I'll give you both. I'm going to send you both those columns plus the July column.
But does language evolve like that? I mean, can language evolve to, you know, produce new words?
Sure. I mean, I guess. People, there are all kinds of words we use that, you know, that become a part of the jargon. And I, you know, listen, when I'm speaking, it's one thing. When you're writing, it's another. One thing that drives me nuts, everything is amazing. It's amazing. I mean, I remember when I was a kid. I mean, I'm talking before anyone around here was born. I was a kid and they had amazing comics, you know, and then incredible. Everything's incredibly difficult. If it's incredible, it's not credible.
Right.
It sort of loses something after a while, you know, and a lot of the obscenities that are used now, I don't even like the word obscenity because it's just words. Words aren't the thing themselves. You know, semanticists will tell you that. But the point is, the really great four-letter words are used so common they've lost.
Right.
they've lost their punch.
Yeah. It's true. Toni Morrison actually had this commentary on the word awesome.
Yeah,
She was saying, doesn't anyone think about what the word awesome actually means? She said, I go to Starbucks, I get my coffee, I pay the money. She says, awesome.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
You know, Art, I can't say that I've been wanting to ask you this for a long time, but in anticipation of you coming in, I had a couple questions I wanted to ask you. You were sort of talking about the life of writing and your history on the Court of Appeal. Can you point to any one or two or three opinions that you've written that you're most proud of in the effect they've had on the legal system, on the way people's lives are affected as a result of that?
I can think of one or two. One case I wrote that it went all over the country, and it was on the front page of the LA Times. And even Herb Cain, who is a pretty well-known columnist in San Francisco, devoted a whole column to it. And it was just a fun case. And it was, Jerry Pack was a wonderful Superior Court judge, very well admired. You knew him.
Sure.
And I remember he said, for every case name I remember, I forget a line of poetry. I thought that was so wonderful. So I use his quote, and I give him credit, obviously. But anyway, I wrote it's called McDonald versus Scripps Howard newspaper. And I wrote it several years ago. And it was a kid who lost a spelling bee contest, and he sued. And I wrote about what a frivolous case it was. It was it was very funny, hysterically funny. But I wrote it in a way that I didn't want to embarrass the kid. And so I told him that. And he had won, he was a finalist in California. And they gave him, there was a spelling bee case. And there was a word, I even remember the word horsey, H-O-R-S-Y, or H-O-R-S-E-Y. You could spell it either way. So the two top kids spelled it. One spelled it one way, one spelled it the other. And they had both, they were a tie. And they said, we have to have a winner, so we're going to give you another word. And he lost. So he said it was unfair. He should have, well, come on. This was a frivolous lawsuit. And I sort of took the lawyer on. I remember the opening line was something like, when should a lawyer say no to a client? And I talked about the litigation explosion and went through a number. I quoted a number of poets, Wordsworth and everything. And then I remember I said, and I remember his name. It was Gavin. And I said, he has much to be proud of. He was in this contest. He won, and, you know. And I mentioned Grantland Rice. It's not how you, whether you win or lose, it's how you play the game and how well he played it. And then the Superior Court judge who heard it is now a colleague of mine on the Court of Appeal. But he was sitting on that court, and he said, you have a giant causation problem here. And I quoted that. At the end, I said, and if you're not sure how we're going to rule, and we were affirming the trial court, I said, we'll spell it out for you. And I wrote affirmed, but misspelled it. And deliberately, you know, and spelled it in caps.
Right.
And, you know, and it was an essay on I didn't want the kid to suffer for it. So I praised him, and that case really was quite important. And another case I wrote, a lawyer was conscripted to represent an indigent party in a paternity case. And it's of a complicated, I don't want to go through all the issues. But anyway, I said that you couldn't do that because what lawyers are you going to pick to do it and not pay them? So, for example, if someone's a corporate lawyer, they're not going to know how to do this kind of a case. So it would be a trial lawyer who would have to work for nothing. And maybe they're a sole practitioner. How do you decide? And I thought there was a real issue here. And so I published that case. And it was a very important case. And the Supreme Court took it.
Oh.
So I said, great, we're going to get an answer from this. And they sat on it forever. And then the Supreme Court reissued my opinion and said, all courts are to follow Justice Gilbert's case. And they didn't write their own case. They used my case. So I was a fairly new justice.
That is impressive.
I was, and it was cited by Supreme Courts in other states. And that was really quite, I have to admit, I felt very good about it. And I just recently wrote another case that I'm very supportive of the Me Too movement, but this was a case where a kid had been charged with raping a woman on campus he didn't, first of all, the evidence showed that it absolutely it didn't happen. In fact, there were witnesses, including the victim's best friend, who said, I was right there. They were sleeping they were kids and they came from a party. They were on a mattress. One was under the mat. One was, he was just sleeping and that didn't happen.
But nevertheless, he was obviously convicted because have come to you if he hadn't been.
He was thrown out of school. And he didn't get a hearing. They didn't allow the evidence that the young woman had been taking a medication that caused her to hallucinate. She had a bad dream. They took her home. They kept so much evidence out. And he had a neurological disorder, which would prevent him from doing what. Anyway, I reversed that case, obviously, and pointed out that how ironic it was that a university that's supposed to teach due process, American history, and so on, so should be so lacking in their own.
Art, what year was that?
That was just probably 2-3 years ago, 2000.
So post Me Too movement.
2018. It has nothing to do with the Me Too movement, but I'm just saying, we have to look at objectively at every case and not have a political point of view when we're deciding cases.
Well, I do think that movements, and I won't dig too deep into this, but I do think that popular movements that take hold do impact, I don't know that they impact the outcome of cases, maybe they do, but they impact public opinion, and so they impact the reactions of entities like schools or whoever else when these kinds of, hot rod issues come up.
Absolutely. And they impact legislation.
That's the whole idea, right?
That's the whole idea. And then we're interpreting the... Now, this was a due process case.
Mm-hmm.
You're entitled to
have
a fair... To fair hearing. Look, if a serial murderer is entitled to due process, some kid who got kicked out of law school is entitled to it, too. And there were plenty of cases where women have been discriminated against where we've come down on their side. So it's not
my point was just that the reaction of the school is a product of that whatever big movement is going on. We have a big movement going on now, and I'm sure there'll be consequences to that. Steve knows this. I've always been the proponent of, people pay attention. The policies we have are a product of the people that live in this world. If you pay attention to politics and policy, something everybody says, well, I don't do, I don't like politics. But the reality is if you pay attention, the policies reflect your values and your attention. If you're not paying attention, then someone else is making the policies. And one day you open your eyes and you realize you don't like it.
You have to protect democracy or you'll lose it.
Absolutely.
You have to be involved.
I think we're all aware of that nowadays, more than ever.
More than ever. Absolutely. Yeah.
I want to ask you one more question. Yeah. I know we're getting close to the end. So the flip side of what I asked you a moment ago, opinions that you were most proud of. Are there any that you wrote and you now look back on and say, gosh, I wish I'd done that differently, either written it differently or come to a different conclusion?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I wrote one case that it was an environmental impact case. And the Supreme Court reversed me. And I was so glad they did. I was wrong.
Wow, how fair.
And they were, it's not fair. It's just, honestly, it's not a question of fair. Thank you for saying that. And I don't mean to throw a compliment back at you. But I mean, it's not a question of fair. It's, you know, you as a judge, you take an oath of office. And look, we have disagreed. My colleagues and I, we really are brothers. We're so close. And we disagree on all kinds of things. And the Supreme Court reversed me. And I saw one of the justices, you know, afterward. And I said, boy, were you guys right? I'm thinking of one case in particular, another environmental case, in which I didn't realize it. A city attorney that you and I knew was the plaintiff on an environmental case. I can't think of his name. And he had a house in Santa Barbara on the beach, Montecito somewhere. And he wanted to build in the second story. And he had a dedicated part of his property. But he wasn't changing anything. He was just putting a second story. And I was questioning whether, in fact, it's one thing if you build a seawall that creates an eroding shoreline. And we've written cases like that and say, hey, you've got to dedicate part of your property. If you're going to do that, you're affecting the public. On this case, I wasn't sure. And my colleague said, oh, absolutely, he has to do it. And so I said, nah, I'm not. I almost have the name of the case. So I said, nah, I don't think so. And I was a little lazy, and I didn't write a dissent. The case goes to the California Supreme Court. They deny review. I said, ah, what a break. Okay, I did the right thing. Goes to the U.S. Supreme Court. They grant review. 4-5 decision reversing us. Justice Scalia wrote the opinion. Now, I got to be honest with you. I seldom agree with Justice Scalia. But this one I did. And Brennan, who I agree with many times, wrote the dissent. 5-4. Andrea Orton, who was my girlfriend in high school, argued the case in front of the Supreme Court. Is this amazing? And so anyway, so we get reversed. And I said, you know something? I agree with Justice Scalia. Turns out, years later, I meet Justice Scalia. Why? Because the book that my published books, Brian Garner, who is the editor of Black's Law Dictionary and a professor of English, he's the one that encouraged me to have my columns published. And I got a fairly good big publisher to publish them, and that's what happened. And he wrote a book with Justice Scalia, and they were promoting the book, and I thought I ought to go there. And he says, how'd you like to meet Justice Scalia? I said, fine. So he and I spent 10 or 15 minutes alone, just Justice Scalia and myself, and we're chatting. He's a guy that you think you would know all your life. I mean, the most congenial, everybody says that about him. He's just I told him, I said, my God, you're such a warm, friendly person. How can you write those opinions? You know, and he's laughing. He didn't care what I think. And I mentioned the case. And he says, oh, yeah, that case. I said, well, I said, that's where we got reversed. And I have to tell you, I agree with you there.
And had you written the dissent, would it have sounded like his opinion?
Well, I would have written in a different style, but
Same substance?
Yeah, absolutely.
Wow, interesting.
Yeah, I think he was right because the change that they made in their house didn't impact anything. It didn't affect the view. It didn't affect the public in any way. And there is such a thing as property rights. You don't get, I mean, if I add an addition to my house, but it doesn't impact anybody or anything, why should I have to dedicate part of my private property? I mean, that was the argument.
Right, got it.
And it made sense. Now, if you do something that's going to affect the view, that's going to affect the environment, even in subtle ways, yes, there's law and that's what the law is. So anyway, it's just on the tip of my tongue. And as soon as this broadcast is over, I'll
remember it.
But I guess the name of the case isn't really important.
So your two regrets are on environmental law. Interesting.
You know, I'm sure I have more regrets if I still
send us an email when you're done and we'll add it on.
Yeah, we could have another 4-hour show about my regrets.
So given the fact that this is the Pally podcast, tell us your favorite thing about the Palisades. Actually, you know what? What I really want to know is I want you to tell me your least favorite change in the Palisades, but we'll start slow. Tell us your favorite thing about the Palisades.
Well, when you say the least, can I go with the least favorite first?
Your least favorite change. Yeah.
The density, the crowds, don't even go near Sunset Boulevard after 3 o'clock. Things are a little different now with the COVID, but it's very crowded. And also, I'll tell you another thing. I have to admit, there's some really wonderful, friendly people here. And maybe when you get older, younger people are not as interested in you. Maybe I was that way. I hope not. But I find that there is not as much in the Palisades as other places, a certain lack of civility. When you're driving, people are cutting you off. People walk in front of you sometimes. I sound like an old curmudgeon now. And I'm not saying everyone's like that. But I think when you have more people, but on the other hand, I like the sense of community.
And you love the Palisadian Post, right?
Oh, are you kidding? absolutely. And I'm a subscriber.
They've done stories on. They've written at least one good one.
They've done several stories on me, actually. And yes, I feel there's a real sense of community, and people want to do things to improve the community.
Very much so.
And I like that very much. There's a bluff outside of my house that they're going to change, and I want to be involved in that, making it a nice park and that kind of thing. So I think there's still a great sense of community. I love the 4th of July. Steve and I we used to run the 10K.
Every year.
Then we ran the 5K. Now we walk.
We walk the 5K now.
This year you can just make a donation and get a t-shirt because no one's going to be running or walking.
I know we don't have time, but can I tell you a quick story about the 10K?
Yes, absolutely. Well,
okay. Well, no, this is, and I wrote a column about this. So I'm with some friends now and I'm in my 70s and I'm running the 5K. And they're now announcing the winners, and they get to my category, and I came in third, and I get a medal, and they call me, and some of my friends are there. I get on the stage to get my medal, and I'm hamming it up. You know, I said I want to thank all the little people who made this possible, and I'm joking around. It's me. It's who I am. You know, and I'm showing it, and then they say great, and that was the category for 75 to 80. But I was 72 or 73. And I thought, I said, wait a minute. He said 75. And they said, no, you're fine. I said, no, I heard it.
Oh, wow.
And they're saying, no. And my friends, I said, no, I can't do this. So I run into the office or where the guy is. I said, I just got a medal. I don't think I have to see what my birthday, what you have down. So he looks, it's the wrong birthday.
Oh, no.
I didn't deserve it. I came in fourth, not third. I said, oh, my God, I can't do. So I take my medal off. I give it to the guy. He said, who's third? And he gives me the name. I say, how do we get a hold of him? So the guy is looking at me. I'm demanding it. And so I said, we've got to let this guy know. I'm giving this thing back. I don't want it. Please. And we're having this big discussion. And I'm in a panic. So the guy says, I promise I'll do this. I said, I want your name and email so I can call you and make sure. And here's mine. I give him. So we're walking out and the guy says, you are just wonderful. And I said, what? He says, look what you're doing. You're not. So I said, look and think for a moment. You are telling me I'm wonderful because I'm not accepting something I didn't win. That doesn't make me wonderful. And the fact that you think it does, what does that say? I didn't want to knock him for saying that. But I say, what does that say about where we live now? I couldn't enjoy it. Am I going to wear it? And I'd be a fraud. So I said, thank you for doing that, for saying that to me. But so I wrote an article. I write an article about it, and I have a column about it. And then the next year, I said, I've got to come in third.
And in the right category.
Right. And I ran my tail off, and I came in third.
Wow.
Legit. And I got the thing. And anyway, I wrote a column and I had a picture of me getting the award, which was a legit award. But that was a wonderful moment in my life, and it was
I
so much fun.
I love that story.
So these kinds of stories give me all kinds of ideas to write columns.
And that's so Palisadian. Brian Shea, I hope you're listening, and I hope you now know that just this Arthur Gilbert gave back an undeserved third medal. I love that story. What a perfect Palisadian note to end on.
At another time, I might say that's an awesome story, but I
I think it's incredible.
It's amazing,
and
too.
And amazing.
It's amazing, incredible, awesome. And you really are amazing, incredible, awesome. It's been such a pleasure to talk to you. I have a feeling we could do this for another couple of hours.
Thank you so much. Thank you for inviting me. I enjoyed it immensely.
For those of you that want to read more about Art Gilbert, you can get both of his books, Under Submission and Under Submission Volume 2. It's delightful reading. Okay. You don't have to be a lawyer.
I have to say this. All the proceeds go to legal aid, legal charities. I don't get a cent. The publisher is a billion-dollar company. They don't get any money. We made a deal.
And it's available on Amazon right now.
And also, I have a blog, and they're on the blog as well. If you look up Justice Arthur Gilbert, you can see many of the columns.
Such a pleasure to talk to you,
Justice. Same here. This was a joy. Thank you.